listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 18th installment of a conversation that we've been having with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy, the history, in essence, of the founding and the untimely demise of the USSR, the period from, say, 1917 until 1991. Luciana, it's a pleasure to have you with us again.
Thank you, Dan.
So we left off in Spain, really in Catalonia, which is an interesting place to leave off these days. and we were talking about essentially how the war was lost when you had essentially the government in power being attacked by fascists who at the beginning were kind of feuding with each other. You had the left and the anarchists and popular forces generally siding with the government. And then we got to the point where there were groups that decided to go it alone. They decided, instead of working in coalition with the rest of the society, that now was the time for revolution while they were under attack. And we were starting to get to how that played out. So let's go there.
That's right. Last time we talked about the economic effects of the social revolution that the anarchists and I shall call them Trotskys, the PUM, engineered in parts they were in control of, and namely Catalonia, Aragon, and places like that. And we demonstrated, we talked about, last time, about how this taking over of the means of production created economic chaos. Right. Nobody knew who should decide, and we went into that last time. But today, I want to talk about how the Republic of Spain, the loyalist side, the Republican side, formed its own army, because we have to remember that when Franco arrived in Spain, he had with him inside Spain the whole military echelons, the higher upper echelons, the whole military command, you know, whatever we would call the Pentagon. So he came with forces from Spanish Morocco, and the army of what had been the army of the Republic sided with Franco, which meant that the Republic had a very minimal army.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
It had some officers and some, but, you know, and this is what I want to talk about, how this army was formed mainly through the efforts of the Spanish Communist Party in tandem and together with Moscow, and really quite obstructed in its formation in the beginning by the forces of the anarchists and what I call the Trotskyists, the PUM. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good outline of it too. Good. So let's do that.
Okay. So after Franco's led military rebellion, the Republic was left with a decimated officer corps and a severely weakened army in the regions which were in the Republic's control. So the army, this army, was the one that had been unable to resist the rebellion. So the fighting mainly fell to the militia units organized by the various labor unions. So the CNT had its own militia, the PUM had its own militia, the UGT had its own militias. And I think, if I may interject here, this is the idea of a people's army that comes up. It was also the sort of formation that worked in the Russian Revolution initially. But anyway, so the militias were inexperienced; they lacked discipline and coordination. Unlike in Soviet Union in World War II, they didn't have a Stavka; they didn't have a general staff directing the war.
Right.
Imagine. So. So these militias even had a rivalry between them.
Yeah.
And this, you know, who would get what arms? There was no central command distributing arms, organizing transportation. Think about it. So because they lack a centralized command and general staff. And those people who say that, you know, Stalin wasn't significant in World War II, it was the people who fought.
Yeah, right.
Well, no, they had a central command, a Stavka.
Yeah.
Made up of generals.
I posted today at my Facebook page, had stumbled on YouTube, a radio address that Stalin gave on, I think it was July 3rd. Of 1941. Now, Hitler attacked, I think it was June 22nd of 1941. So this is, you know, 10, 11 days later. He spoke for about 28 minutes and essentially outlined the strategy that was going to be followed, which ended up being the strategy that was followed, which ended up being the strategy that won the war. You know, we're talking about this scorched earth policy as it came to be known. He didn't use that terminology then. And a people's war, in essence. And, you know, you've got all these other folks that have, you know, from
together,
mommies.
Yeah.
But you've got people who since then have been looking at, you know, what happened in Soviet Union and contrasting what they say happened with what should have happened, people's wars and people's revolutions. But in fact, that was a people's war, and it was won because it was a people's war, and
that's
Stalin
right,
designed it over the radio.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, no. And I'm saying, and Stalin basically called for it over the radio at the very beginning.
That's right. And I forget what the percentage of communist members were in the army, but they weren't overwhelming.
Right.
I mean, they were large.
Larger than the society at large, but not, right. It wasn't even a majority, I don't think.
No, that's right. And that alone makes it a people's
that's
army.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah, but a people's army has to have an organization that directs it too.
Well, yeah, if you want to win. Yeah, if you want to win. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So this is another contrast, you know, not having an organized, what is the Stavka called?
Yeah, like an officer's corps or whatever, you know, a hierarchy,
it's
essentially.
It's a central planning committee.
Yeah, yeah, right, okay, right.
Of the war.
Okay, right.
I mean, the Pentagon, I think. But, yeah. Okay. Well, I don't know. Not even the Pentagon. But anyway, what was the Stavka? It was a...
You're talking about the general staff, basically. The you
general
know,
the, staff.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Exactly. Okay. Excellent.
Right.
And this militia lacked weapons. And because, of course, the army had taken what they needed, Franco's armies. They lacked heavy weapons. So, and in addition, they lacked heavy weapons, which one, so there were three players in the Spanish, foreign players in the Spanish Civil War, Germany, right. Italy,
right.
And the Soviet Union.
That's right.
The Franco got 2/3 of the total army of the foreign weapons from Italy and Germany,
right.
and a third was supplied to the Republic by the Soviet Union. 600 planes, I don't know, 700 pilots, right. Advisor, a considerable contribution by the Soviet Union to the Republicans. So 1/3. You know, 2/3 of the foreign weapons went to Franco. 1/3 went to the Republic by the Soviet Union. Britain and France contributed nothing.
Mexico, however, did. Mexico
did.
Threw a couple of million dollars and 20,000 rifles and some other things, and
that's
and
right,
political
that's right.
support. They took a strong political stance, backing the government.
That's right. They had their own revolution.
Yeah, that's right.
So in the initial months of the Civil War in 1936, after July, the Ministry of War had little authority over transport because, as we noted, the transport was in the hands of the CNT, of the Anarchist Union, trade union, and was forced to rely on the National Committee of Road Transport, that is, the Ministry of War, which, as I said, was controlled by the CNT and the UGT.
Mm.
The Anarchist Union is the CNT, and the UGT is the Socialist Party Union.
Right.
So anyway, the committees, the unions, and the parties disregarded demands from the Ministry of War and retained equipment and vehicles for themselves and their own militia forces, which sometimes, you know, eventually they turned on each other.
Right.
One second, I have my outline here. And a recalcitrant computer.
Yeah, we all have those. While you're doing that, you know, I'm looking, meanwhile, you've got the, also the... some minor players on the international stage. Portugal, for example, was involved.
Yes.
The Irish government prohibited participation. The IRA sent the Irish Brigade to fight alongside Franco. And that was based on Catholicism, apparently, to fight communism.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, they were fighting communism in defense of the Catholic Church.
Ooh.
This was even O'Duffy, the Irish Brigade.
But now we're in 1936, so which Ireland was it? The North?
No. This is it was Ireland.
This
I don't
the
I remember.
Republic of Ireland.
This is the IRA. This is the IRA. Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah.
Very strange how these so-called lefties manage.
Well, you have, what you had going on, two things that I think were probably attractive. One, you know, that attracted those elements. Number one, you know, the nationalist struggle in the UK of Ireland against the Brits. Religion is the sort of the soil that takes place in, or in any event, that's the dressing that they put on it, and Catholicism. And so they had that in common because they were painting the Republicans, whether they were just liberals or even not so liberal supporters of the government all the way out to the communists, as, you know, secularists and atheists and hostile to the Catholic Church. So the Catholic, you know, they were rallying fellow Catholics. And also, you had nested within that the nationalist struggles in both Basque and Catalonia, which, of course, the Irish could identify with at that time as well. So it's complex, you know.
Sure, but I have to add something else.
Sure.
In 1921, I think that's the date, you had a civil war in Ireland and the socialist side won. So what you have in power in Ireland is a compromised IRA.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, so because the usual excuse is whoever fights Britain, we're on their side.
Right.
Whether it's Hitler or in India, whatever, on their side. But
that's
this is not the case, except that Britain was fighting against the Republic passively by not helping and et cetera.
Right.
So I would think that because the, let's say, the socialist branch of the Irish Republic in 1921 lost the Civil War, this is the consequence of that defeat, is that the existing Irish government in Dublin sided with the fascist on grounds of Catholic, possibly Catholic, sympathy.
Yeah, you know, by the way, O'Duffy was also the head of what they called the NCP, which was a fascist party, National Corporate Party, and he was the one that was recruiting. And they had sent about 7,000 people in the Irish Brigade, but it became a real problem at home, as it turns out. Sorry, we're off the track. Let's get back, because go ahead. So
because of, and this is early in 1936, because of the need in 1936, because there was this need to create a centralized military, a centralized run military, the Communist Party of Spain was in favor of establishing a regular army and integrating the militias into this new force. So they, the Communist Party, were the first to dissolve their militia forces, including the 5th Regiment, which is one of the most effective units in the war, and create a mixed brigade, a people's army, forming the core of the new popular army. These units, however, were firmly under the oversight of the Communist Party. One second.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I'm having this trouble today.
That's okay. These things happen. I'll update, by the way. I just found, as a matter of fact, there was also, although it was smaller, an Irish brigade, the International Brigade, sent organized by the Communist Party of Ireland, that supported strongly the Republican side in the Civil War, and like a quarter of them died, you know, fighting that war. They were, you know, they were heroic. So
amazing.
You know, they put in their, you know, they were well represented on our side as well.
And so, yeah, the Popular Army. So these units were firmly under the oversight of Communist Party commissars, and that would be from Moscow, and under the command of experienced army officers. So, I mean, the Communist Party eventually came to to dominate the leadership of the new army through their commissars, Soviet advisors, and NKVD agents, also exercised considerable influence within the new armed forces. All of this presence of communists in the struggle seems to have really upset the anarchist and the communist.
Right.
The CNT, the anarchist trade union, and the PUM, the Marxist.
The Trotsky
side, and other socialist militias initially resisted the integration. Imagine.
Right.
Resisted the integration. The CNT, the anarchist trade union, saw the militias as representing the will of the people, while a centralized army was against their anti-authoritarian principles.
I mean, you talk about being chained down by ideology.
Yes.
You know, it's so clear.
Abstraction.
Yeah, exactly.
They're amazing, yes. They also fear the army as an organ of the Communist Party. So we see that in Spain, communism represented a threat for a sizable fighting force on the side of the Republicans.
That's right.
Communism was seen, if you stretch it, communism was as bad as fascism. Isn't that the ideology of some weird lefties today?
Well, that's certainly of anarchists. You know, the Soviet Union was, in essence, the same as Nazi Germany. It's just different forms. You know, that, well,
amazing.
The stock certificates are in the name of the government or the people in this case, instead of in the name of the actual owners, but it operates the same way. That's their argument, it's distilled down from absurdity to something intelligible.
Yeah. So the CNT, the Anarchist Union, were eventually forced to yield to militarization, since the government refused to supply arms to the militias unless they joined the regular army.
Right.
But so we have events in Catalonia of May, which 3-day kind of uprising against essentially the communist direction of the war. And this is what George Orwell celebrates in Homage to Catalonia.
Mm.
And out of the Spanish Civil War comes a mythology that the Stalinist, this word Stalinist Soviet Union had crushed the social revolution, which we have seen last time, seized all the businesses and brought the production, the economic production, to a standstill. So had crushed this amazing social revolution, which would have, in the mythology, seized the land from the landlords and seized the factories and then didn't know how to rule it, had this wonderful militia, spontaneous people's army.
It would have rolled right over the borders and swept across Europe and then the whole world with the revolution. That's the mythology.
Amazing. Yeah. While Germany was providing 600 planes, Italy 700, and to Franco, and I don't know what to say.
And the USSR providing 600-800 planes also to the other side. In other words, Orwell offered some typewritten words or handwritten words, and while the Trotskyists were offering poems and tribute to the heroic people, the Soviet Union was building and shipping and building an infrastructure for transshipping armaments to the people to protect themselves from the fascists.
That's right. They were trying to save a simple the state. Like Russia did with Syria.
With Syria, that's exactly right. You're looking at the way imperialism is treating you know, world events now, nation states now, they essentially turn them into failed states. And so, you know, when you step in and prop up states just so that they can remain intact, provide basic services, not create another, you know, area that's on fire socially, politically, militarily, and everything else, that necessary step is looked at somehow as counter-revolutionary.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, exactly right. This is it. If, you know, the Soviet Union hadn't intervened, it would have been immediately taken over
right.
by
like Czechoslovakia. Yeah.
So these two myths came out of the Spanish. I was saying that two myths developed. One, that Stalinist Soviet Union had crushed the people's social revolution of the anarchists and the Trotskyists, and that they did so to somehow please Britain and France.
Yeah, that was a brilliant strategy.
That is, that Stalin didn't back the social revolution because this would have upset Britain and France, and he was such a fool not to understand, according to this logic, that France and Britain would egg on Hitler to attack the Soviet Union. Ha, 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 ha.
Right.
Isn't he stupid?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of... They impute, like, you know, the personal characteristics of you know, individual behavior to to nation states. You know, Hitler might have thought that he was Germany, and the people on the ground, some of them, might have thought that he was Germany. But in general, the industrialists, the capitalists, the military leaders, they all knew, you know, what time it was. And so you don't goad Hitler or you don't goad Germany into war. They do a calculation. And because the mythology is he was crazy, started a two-front war, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure that there's some aspect of that that's true. But in reality, the number of resources that you have to mobilize and the cooperation that's required from thousands of senior administrators, generals and officers in the military and the the pinnacles of production and the rest of the society. It doesn't work that way. And so Stalin, knowing this, since he's sitting in the midst of a group of people that are building an economy from whole cloth to protect itself from what's coming from Hitler, understands this, and yet they, you know, they have this kind of popular myth that, well, Stalin didn't want to get Britain and France mad at him, and so they went in and they betrayed the revolution, and he just got betrayed, and that's what happened. That's basically, it's like you're hearing a 5-year-old narrative, you know, a 5-year-old child's narrative.
Yeah. So there's the first myth was this that we talked about just now. And the second charge against Stalin, and I noticed that Chomsky supports this one. This one is really quite insane, I think, in a metaphorical sense.
Understood. Yes, I gotcha.
And the second myth is that Stalin, failed to support the nationalist mobilization, nationalist anti-imperialist mobilization in Spanish Morocco, which was brewing, I don't know how to the boil it was, but which was brewing, so that if Stalin had at the same time supported a anti-colonial struggle mobilization in Spanish Morocco, this would have weakened Franco's army, and therefore Stalin lost the Spanish Civil War by not doing that.
Which is
now
insane.
Are we understanding that there are two things here, two myths, two things that could not happen
at the same
anyway.
Time? Certainly not at the same time.
The Soviet Union wasn't doing a Bolshevik revolution in Spain. That's up to the Spaniards.
That's right.
It was defending, that's what we said, that's up to the Syrians.
That's right.
You know? What he was defending is what you said, the integrity of a state.
That's right.
That is, stay together and then do the Bolshevik revolution when you are together, if you like.
If you like, right.
And the second thing is, they expected these left and even today, expected Stalin and, you know, to mount an anti-colonial revolution and support it in Morocco while Stalin knew Hitler was at the gates, almost.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the theory, again, it's in this magical thinking universe that some of these folks reside in, that if you light matches everywhere, you can set everything ablaze, and at the end of the day, there will be a communist paradise that will spring up magically in its place. That all you need do is burn down the forest, and you know, yes. And utopia, it lies under the ashes or inside the, I don't know, somewhere. Yeah. Maybe it's in one of the trees and it falls out. I don't know. But
I don't know.
The reality of it is that
it's the myth of the Phoenix.
We're talking in 1936, 1937, 1938. We're talking 20 years or less since the country withdrew from World War I, devastated, a revolution, a brand new economy that started on the ashes of a feudal economy, in essence, with some economic development in the cities, you know, some industrial development in the cities. They are about to be attacked by basically the rest of Europe, except for the UK. By the time they come, they've conquered or allied with the rest of Europe. And while we're constructing our defenses here, and trying to preserve this nation state at the rear end of this thing, let's go fight over in Africa, by the way, and see if we can't spark an anti-colonial revolution there. Yeah. We're going to have to pick that up there next week because we're out of time.
Let me just interrupt a second if you have a minute.
No, we don't. We have 30 seconds.
What we're going to do then is that the Soviet Union did learn some lessons.
Yes, they did. And we'll have to pick it up there next week. Luciana, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Bye-bye, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Double-crossed? You would think so if it occurred. Also, just how many U.S. troops are in Syria and why? And the living hell that is Yemen. Crosstalking some real news, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Viktor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And, of course, we have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect, as usual. There's so much to talk about today, but we can't overlook Thomas Friedman's article in the New York Times, Saudi Arabia's Arab Spring, at last.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Gentlemen, this article is breathtaking for so many reasons. Victor, your immediate takeaway after reading it.
Look, this is somebody who said give war a chance before the second Iraq war. This is somebody who told the American public about the chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons programs that are progressing with unbelievable speed in Iraq. What's the result of that? Hundreds of thousands of people dead from the American occupation, and what happened after that with ISIS and everything else. And today, Friedman is claiming that...
Well, he's writing like a publicist for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia.
He's been like that. The point is, Friedman has been a propagandist for decades, for his whole entire career. And we see that, and we see that with this article, this the new royal, so the king-to-be, right, the pretender to the throne, is... is shown as a progressive,
Friedman,
as a reformer.
And Friedman shows himself to be a pretend journalist. Go ahead.
Exactly.
You guys are reading this all wrong. This torrid love letter was one of the most heartfelt examples of true tolerance, right? Between they can exist, the platonic love that can exist between two men.
Bromance.
I think this goes beyond bromance. I think what we need to say about this is that, I mean, Thomas Friedman is the New York Times' favorite pro-globalization, pro-empire columnist. He is embarrassing the New York Times. At the very least, the New York Times could have gotten some advertising revenue and made Saudi Arabia pay for this sycophancy, this stenography. Well, Friedman even said, Mohammed bin Salman instructed me not to write. I mean, this is a journalist?
This is good. This is journalism at its very best in the West right now. Go ahead.
Well, I just love this story about Prince Mohammed bin Salman throwing some of these princes into a gilded jail, that is Ritz-Carlton Houghton, and they started to cough up some money. You know, Mr. Friedman forgets that also the Lebanese prime minister had to have an unplanned vacation in Saudi Arabia for 18 days.
Well, one has to wonder how much he was squeezed for as
Absolutely.
Well. A lot of people have to remember that the Lebanese prime minister has a lot of business interests with the Saudis.
And the embarrassment is that the European press noticed it. And basically the French president Macron, even the French press admits it was not a big gain for Macron. Actually, they were both humiliated by Mohammed bin Salman. You know, the Lebanese prime minister Saad al-Hariri and the French president. And let me tell you that this is not the first time that the Western press is enthusiastic about people throwing people in jail and then getting money from them. Saakashvili did the same thing with Shevardnadze's family in Georgia, and they had nothing but praise for him. Now, Mohammed bin Salman, you know, this anti-corruption drive about which Friedman writes that all the Saudis whom he met had nothing but effusive support for this action. Well, if you don't have effusive support for it in Saudi Arabia, you're in trouble. You're not going to be just worn out by Thom Friedman.
You're going to get shaken down.
We have talked how the phrase the Arab Spring is a brand, a failed idea that
it's
mostly resulted...
It was called Sunni winter is what it should be called.
It was in a growth of Islamism and attacks on Christian orthodoxy across the Middle East and North Africa. But Thomas Friedman, by referring to Mohammed bin Salman's purges and murders to secure the crown for himself as the Arab Spring in Saudi Arabia, puts the final nail in that tired old coffin.
Beatrice and Sidney Webb. Yeah, I hope our viewers know what I'm talking about. Victor, go ahead. We have to go check. We have to move gears. We're going to talk about the Kurds.
Yeah, as far as the Arab Spring, what it led to is chaos. It's disintegration in the Middle East. It's wars in Libya, in Syria, in other parts of the region. Nothing good.
I refer all of our readers to Robert Fisk's latest thing, echoing what Victor just said there. U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East doesn't exist anymore. Go ahead.
Well, just a small conclusion about Thomas Friedman's Arab Spring. You know, if Nabokov's Spring came on roller skates, Thomas Friedman's Spring comes on aircraft carriers. Beware of Thomas Friedman's Spring anywhere in the Arab world or in any other country.
With Prince Salman's reputation now, with his failure in Lebanon, with his failure in his policies in Yemen, with his other failures inside Saudi Arabia, no great PR from Friedman is going to save his reputation now.
Okay, gentlemen, what's going on? Donald Trump has told his new friend now, the president of Turkey, that the U.S. will no longer be supporting the Kurds in northern Syria.
According to everything.
I said was true, and now it gets a little blurry.
This is according to Erdogan and his regime in Turkey. He says that Donald Trump promised him in a phone call that he would stop supplying arms to the Kurds, which the Turks refer to in Syria as Kurdish terrorists, quote unquote. Here's the problem here is the U.S. has made similar promises to Turkey before, and they lied and they continued supplying arms. Now, Trump couched this with Twitter tweets, once again reiterating that what he refers to as the bringing peace to the mess he inherited there,
right,
and that what a mistake in lives and at $6 trillion worth.
And the last sentence is most important.
However, Mattis and the Pentagon, which are really running military and foreign policy, may not be on the same page. And according to the Wall Street Journal, military spokesmen, unnamed again, military officials, have said that they have not received any instructions on this matter. And even if they were to stop supplying arms to the Kurds, they could continue supplying them to the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are 95% Kurds.
So the takeaway, Victor, is that Donald Trump is it's a foreign policy of one man.
Look, what happened was there was a summit between Putin, Erdogan, and Rouhani in Sochi. Of course, the Americans felt that that Russia has slighted them with its own much more successful policy in Syria, a policy devoted to stabilizing the region, not making it more chaotic, what the Americans were doing for the last 6 years, and actually much longer than that, for decades. And so Trump felt that he had to say something to Erdogan in that conversation to make him more amenable to American wishes. And so he may have promised him something concerning the Kurdish help. But what we know about it is, why have the Americans been helping the Kurds anyway in that region? Because the Americans want a stake in Syria, obviously. They want to be in a position in northern Syria to dictate some of the terms of the post-Civil War settlement.
And to justify their presence there, presumably.
And the military has, according to Erdogan, 13 military bases illegally, without Syrian permission, in northern Syria.
Without anyone's permission.
Unilateral as usual. Go ahead, Dima.
The main result, I agree with Victor, that it was important that the Iranian, Turkish, and Russian leader met in Sochi, and in fact, they are now deciding the fate of Syria. They are deciding what the outcome of the civil war is going to be. I think the fate of Syria will be, of course, decided by Syrians themselves. But what is important is that this so-called High Committee on Negotiations has morphed in Riyadh into just a committee for negotiations. And for the first time, the so-called Cairo platform and Moscow platform were included. These are the real moderates, the people who have been supporting a dialogue with President Assad since the beginning. Okay, there are only eight of them. There are eight from the so-called National Syrian Coalition, supported by the West. In the middle, you have a lot of other groups, including some that simply were ignored by the West for many years. But the blocking stake in this is 11 votes. So if Cairo and Moscow platforms, if they manage to get three on their side, they will have a blocking stake
Who blocks all of
and
this?
Just one more thing about it. You know, there is nothing more embarrassing. If Erdogan becomes a friend of Trump, there is nothing more embarrassing than Trump's friendship. Let me remind you that in July this year, Mr. Trump, when Saad al-Hariri, the Lebanese prime minister, was on a visit to Washington, Trump praised him for resisting Hezbollah. He forgot to tell that Hezbollah is actually a coalition partner. So it was like Putin praising Merkel.
No, that was just ignorance.
He's not going to become Trump's friend for one simple reason. He, as any other world leader today, understands that Trump's words aren't worth much.
Not that and Erdogan's words are worth anything either, but... All right, the important thing is that, yes, Russia has all these accomplishments on the ground. They're trying to move towards a political settlement if they can separate Erdogan from al-Qaeda, which doesn't seem likely to me in Idlib. But the U.S. game is not over yet. When Mad Dog Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who's really running U.S. and military foreign policy, according to our president, says, we're not going to just walk away right now, even though ISIS is military defeated in Eastern Syria, their last territorial acquisitions there have evaporated, and now we have the word out that the leaks that the U.S. military is about to admit that they have far more troops, up to four times.
Hold that thought, Mark. We're going to go to a short break, and after a short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, Dima, over the last few days, we had movement on the anti-Russian front in Europe. Take it away.
Well, there was this so-called Eastern Partnership Summit of the EU states and Azerbaijan, Armenia, Moldova, Belarus, Georgia, you know, the former Soviet republics which border on the European Union, and the EU is almost openly trying to make enemies of Russia out of them. I mean, officially at this summit, they said that this is not directed against Russia, but I think Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain,
her
had a very
quite
nice
strong
footnote to this. You know, here's what she said. We must be open-eyed to the actions of hostile states like Russia, which threaten this European potential and attempt to tear apart our collective strength.
What I just find really remarkable about that is that the forces within the EU itself are tearing itself apart. No one has to push it along. All you need to do is watch. Go ahead, Victor.
Exactly. You know, Theresa May is facing some real trouble at home, and she needs a bogeyman to blame it on. And it's a good opportunity. Russia is always a good opportunity.
Yeah, because it's
meddling.
It's cost-free.
But there's another point. You know, Britain actually had the worst relationship with the Soviet Union during the Cold War than the Americans. So it's no surprise that London today is pushing for another, you know, for even more confrontation with Russia. There's another point. Of course, unlike most other European states, unlike Germany, unlike Italy, France, Britain actually has very little trade, just like the United States. It has very little trade with Moscow, so it has very little to lose. And it's time to push those European countries that do have something to lose to lose. That's what it's trying to do, just like the Americans.
Isn't it amazing, you know, you have a British Prime Minister trying to dictate European foreign policy as they're negotiating Brexit at the same time? It's really remarkable.
This is Theresa May and the British government in this post-imperial decline, trying to pretend to relevance in foreign matters that they simply no longer have, especially after Brexit. And frankly, with Brexit, I'm simply waiting for them to say, oh, it was a Russian bot's fault, and we have
they
to do it over.
They said it. They've already said it.
But officially, I'm waiting for them to cancel it. This Eastern European partnership is a more concerning matter. What's driving this is an Atlanticist ideology. It's a geopolitically expansionist ideology that declares that Europe should be all one, basically under Brussels rule with their value system, if
in
you want to call it values,
rule.
From Lisbon to the Urals and beyond. And let's be honest, this is an ideology of geopolitical expansion, and the EU is focused on expanding its borders,
but
absorbing
countries. They're not tossing out EU membership for Ukraine at this
point. Well, not yet.
They know it's a death knell for them.
It's a second-class colony at this point anyway.
But this summit, I think, was really an eye-opener because they, in their final statement, they required from member states strategic communications, which is
propaganda.
Countering Russian disinformation.
There
which
are
no
propaganda.
More counter-propaganda. Yes. Propaganda.
There are no more pressing concerns than fighting RT. Okay, and they required Ukraine and Moldova to fight against Russian influence, but they didn't promise even a remote possibility of EU membership. Mr. Jean-Claude Juncker opening the summit said that this is not on the agenda. And what Theresa May, what she said was especially astounding for me, talking about Atlanticist ideology. She said, we should not underestimate the enduring attraction of Western society to the post-Soviet state. Well, we should not even underestimate the enduring attraction of Prince Mohammed bin Salman to Thomas Friedman. No vital attraction should be underestimated. But it already cost the people there thousands of lives. The Ukrainian disaster was actually the result of Eastern neighborhood policy of the EU. They were the main drivers of the Maidan, not even the United States.
Just how powerful we are that the prime ministers of all European countries, EU countries, have to meet and spend days and hours discussing how to shut us up.
Okay, so there's four people here. I mean, you know, we're the mouse that roared here. I want to change gears here, something very important. What's going on with this anti-doping and the Winter Olympics that will be held in South Korea in 2018? And it looks like they're, again, on the agenda is to push Russia off.
So as soon as the confrontation between the new Cold War, rose up again between the United States and Russia, the Americans have started pushing these doping accusations, and we know it's the Americans and it's some of the Canadian allies. They're pushing these doping accusations against the Russian Olympic team. We've seen this in 1980. Back then, they were more honest. They didn't blame the Soviet Union for doping. They just said, well, there's a war in Afghanistan. That's why we're not going to come to Moscow, and we're not going to let any of our allies come to Moscow.
And then in 1984...
1994. It was reversed in LA. So, but today we have a situation where there is really no hard evidence by WADA of massive doping or state-sponsored doping. There is a person who is actually under investigation for fraud in Russia. His name is Grigory Rodchenkov, who is now under witness protection in the U.S. He admitted to committing crimes. Exactly.
He tampered
with the evidence. And now he is participating in all these propaganda exercises against
Russia. They And
so there is a maximum.
So he's been flipped.
Yes. There is a maximum and the minimum program the Americans want at this point. The maximum goal is to have the Russian Olympic team banned from taking part in the Olympics just before the presidential elections in Russia, sort of embarrassing Russia this way. And the minimum goal is to create such a nervous atmosphere where Russia is going to have to fight for every single athlete and for every single sports team in that Olympic competition to participate, that the athletes will actually sort of lose their stamina, lose their ability to win.
The irony of all of this, of course, is that the Olympic Games is supposed to be the gold standard of competition.
Well,
okay, and the very best of best, and all I see is this, again, an extension of this propaganda. What kind of Winter Olympics can you have without a Russian team?
Winter Olympics where Western nations win hockey. That's where.
Exactly. Doesn't it devalue every single gold, silver, and bronze medal? It devalues it because you'll never know if you were able to compete against the very, very best. I want to cover some more ground here. Mark, you've been kind of quiet on the Olympics. Tell us what's going on in Novorossiya.
All right.
And we're going to get some different of opinions here, I think.
We've had a bit of what I consider an extremely embarrassing incident in the Lugansk Republic, as it is, which is basically just the city of Lugansk.
And the area around it.
Yeah, one-third of the actual Lugansk Republic that is free from this West-backed putsch forces. The nominal president of the self-declared Republic, Lipinski, someone who... I think it would be generous to say he has the charisma of a wet paper towel. He has been involved in an internal dispute, powers with his interior secretary in charge of the police, Kornets. Mm-hmm. And this has resulted in what seems to be a change of leadership in Lugansk.
Is it good or bad? What kind of direction are we seeing?
Okay, well, on one hand, it certainly shows that the people of Lugansk and their the authorities there have more independence from Russia than anyone has been giving them credit for. On the other hand, it's extremely embarrassing to them, and it shows that there's a very chaotic situation there, and it bodes ill for the West pushing Ukraine to try to settle the matter militarily. But on the other hand, Platinsky was not really loved by anyone, and we may be better off with him gone. Someone more charismatic, like Zaharchenko in Donetsk, his equivalent in Lugansk, might lead Lugansk to a little bit more success.
Well, I think that. The West was very disappointed because the press that they backed reported that Igor Plotnitsky, after being ousted, went to Russia. That's their dream, that they all go to Russia.
Yeah, that's hashtag fake news.
But it was fake news because Plotnitsky is going to represent Lugansk's People's Republic at the negotiations in Minsk from now on. I think what happened is indeed not very good, but the reason for it, I'm sorry, but these are the actions of the West, because they did not allow Lugansk and Donetsk to have elections.
Right.
They have been denying these places the right to have elections since 2014. The idea of Poroshenko is that first we have security, which means having Ukrainian or UN troops on the border with Russia, which means total blockade, because since January, Ukraine is not supplying even electricity and water. They cut food three years ago.
We see what the Saudis have done to Yemen.
Exactly. They want to do the same thing. These republics get their food and water and electricity from Russia. Not because Russia wants to, to feed them, but because Kyiv has cut all the supplies, And if they had elections, they would have had a more legitimate government with which such things would not be possible. But also, please bear in mind that actually the enemy speaks the same language
They watched the same television as you did. This is a civil war. They went to the same school with you. Right. So people are jittery in Lugansk, not because they are cowards, but because the enemy is the same nation, the same people as them.
There's also a very important piece of this. In this entire confrontation that we have seen in Lugansk play out over the last week, not a single person was hurt or died. And that's very different from what's happening in Ukraine, for example, in Kyiv, where people get shot, where politicians get thrown into human rights violations, where people are tortured, where politicians are being maimed and killed and arrested and held without bail and without trial. So that's a very stark difference. And also we have to keep it in context that this Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics are areas where just several million people live, where tens of thousands of people have died over the last three years, because the Ukrainian forces, supported by the West, supported by the United States, supported by the EU, have conducted a massive campaign with bombardments of civil and residential
with
areas,
tanks.
With artillery attacks on schools, on civilian infrastructure.
But they never say President Poroshenko is killing his own people.
Gentlemen, we've run
out of time. Fascinating discussion. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Rostock rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.